Take up your mat and walk. Who was here this morning? Oh, well, you're really going to hate tonight then, aren't you? It's the same message. Hey, look, Joey, thank you very much. Guys, a lot to take in at one sitting, but may I encourage you to try and recall some of the things that Jody was sharing with you, because they certainly are important. Do you know the difference between people living in poverty and ourselves? It's just that they happen to be living in a different country. It could have easily been you, or it could have easily been me, that were born in that country. And there's no difference with them. They're no less intelligent than you and I. Their brain's no smaller or anything like that. It just happens to be the place that they were born into, and it works from there. Mike said very quickly about Korea. Well, I'll give you a quick history of Compassion. Compassion did start in Korea in 1952. And we started with the Orphans of War there. And it happened with our founder, Everett Swanson, who was there as a pastor to the troops. And he happened to be walking through Seoul in the morning, and he saw the garbage collectors picking up the rubbish. And as he was walking past the shop windows, or the shops, he could see that there was cardboard and so forth and so on. And as he was getting closer, he saw these little arms poking out from underneath it. And he saw the garbage collectors coming closer, and so he ran to let them know that, that's not rubbish, that's children. And when he got there, it all came very clear. And they weren't picking up the rubbish. What their job was actually to do was to clear the dead orphans from the streets before work started, put them on a truck and go and dump them. That was very effective for him. He was completely rocked to his core, and as a result, Compassion started. Then in the late 90s, so that was 1952, in the late 90s, our Compassion projects throughout South Korea and our Compassion office there came to Compassion International and said, look, we are now in a situation as a country where we can look after our own. We don't need Compassion any longer, and we want to say thank you very, very much. Please go and take what you were doing with us to another needy country. And so we went across to West Africa. We'd already been in East Africa for many, many years, went to West Africa, into Burkina Faso, and started there. But that wasn't the end of it. So in the early 2000, our now international president, Dr. Wes Stafford, went and met with 1,500 South Korean Christian leaders. And as he was chatting with them and having a breakfast with them, he proposed the idea of South Korea becoming a partner country, like Australia is, for Compassion. So they would advocate, they would raise awareness, they would raise finances so that they could then send that money to other countries where we do work with children in poverty. Guy put his hand up and said, Wes, why are you telling us this for? And Wes goes, oh, great. You know, a public speaker hates it when a person speaks out of turn. It's hard enough to get them to speak when we ask them, but when they speak out of turn, you think you're in trouble. And he goes, oh, I've got a heckler. The guy stood up, introduced himself. He said he was the leader of the Salvation Army, gave his name. He says, I was one of your sponsored children. He said, you don't have to convince me. Another guy put his hand up. He said, I'm the leader of such and such a church. He said, I was a sponsored child. And the hands went up across the room, and there was several hundred who had been previously Compassion-sponsored children. They said, bring it on. So it took us a little while to get it together, but South Korea is the fastest-growing Compassion country in the world at raising awareness, raising finances. And they have some of the largest churches in the world, may I say. So that's just a little bit of sort of reinforcement to what Jody was saying. South Korea was an amazing transformation. We would love that to happen in every country, but it doesn't always happen as fast as we would like it to happen. But that doesn't mean we stop. It doesn't mean we stop. Compassion has four programs. We only have had four programs that happen in the entire world. One is our child survival program, which works with high-risk expectant mothers and their babies. And part of that is working towards eradication of Millennium Development Goals 5 and 6, I think, which is infant mortality and mothers being able to have babies in hospitals and so forth and so on. And so in a local child development centre, which is a part of a local Christian church, we provide that child survival program, which does prenatal, postnatal, antenatal, early childhood development, the GOBF food programs, parental education and micro-enterprise, so that we can train the mother to be in some sort of business or a business with a couple of other ladies where they won't be in a position where they were previously. So that's from the womb. Then it goes into the child sponsorship program. We've got those children out the back, and that goes from 4 years old to 2021. And we provide them with a holistic child development program. And we cover, I think, as I said this morning, the five faces of poverty. So you don't have to think too fast or hard. We all know about economic poverty. That's normally the one we think of first. But there's five, and I try and remember it by going SESPI. So it's spiritual, economic, social, physical, and emotional. They're the five faces of poverty that can hit you anywhere in the world. And probably in Australia, the spiritual one would be one that's fairly predominant from a Christian's perspective, but we have other areas of poverty here as well. And so our holistic child development program works on that. And so we have children. And can you imagine if you're a child? Okay, I've got to make sure I don't go over time. Imagine if you're a child who lives on a dump. So in the front foyer, we've got all these children in Indonesia. Last year, we took that photo. You live on a dump, and so you probably get the opinion of yourself that if I live on the dump, then I'm rubbish, I'm not worth much, I'm worthless. And so you could understand that a child, depending on their circumstance, will have a very poor self-image, and if they don't think that they're worth anything and that no one's going to listen to them, then why should they bother, and so forth and so on. And we get children, and I think I said this morning, compassion works with children because children are the most vulnerable people group in the entire world. Unless an adult speaks up on their behalf, they're not to be heard. Now, I have children, and I know they're quite loud, but that's a different issue. We're talking about if they're being hurt or if they're being mistreated or if they're being in sweatshops or whatever could happen. And so adults need to advocate on their behalf. And so we decided that we wanted to work with these vulnerable children to be able to help them to be able to get on into adulthood in a safe, clean environment where they could enjoy themselves, have fun, learn, get medical care, food, and clothing. And so we run that. And so we have these children, they come in and we tell them, you're not rubbish. God knew you when he knit you together in your mother's womb. And he has a plan for your life. The Bible tells me that he's numbered the hairs on your head. And so we have a program that's designed to be able to help these children to develop and to grow. And a lot of it is extra school or afternoon activities that complement what school, if they go to school, can't provide. And it brings them along. And as they get older, we have in the early stages, we have a file that each child has. And the child has to write out, and, well, they probably can't write in the early days, but they talk about it, and the staff at the child centres work with it, and it's a plan for their life. What is it that they would like to be? What is the dreams and aspiration that these little child might have that one day when they get into young adulthood they may be able to achieve? And so our staff work with them to help them. I was in, I don't remember where I was now, Brazil in 2005. I just not long started with Compassion, and I was in one of the favelas in Rio, and this lady said to me, who was running this project in this slum, and it was the spookiest place I'd ever been to, because when I rolled up, two 15-year-olds with silver guns stopped the car and said, okay, we know who you are, talking about the lady, but the two guys in the back, we don't know who they are. So who are they? And I'm sitting there going, well, this better not be the end of my life, Lord. Anyway, they called the superiors who run the slum, which are the drug lords, and they gave us an hour to be in and out. So anyway, while I was in, there was this little boy, and he was over there with a couple of other guys. He was in a blue shirt, and they were flying kites. She says, that little boy wants to be a doctor. Wants to be a doctor. She goes, whenever the medical team come through, I make sure he's with them all the time. If I know of a doctor who's coming through, I bring him. And she says, he is going to be a doctor, and I'm going to make sure he's going to be one. We take every child and we try and work with them individually so that they can aspire to be what God wants them to be. So when a little child comes through and they get to about 14 or 15, we ask them, can you write it in a story, your situation? Can you type it on a computer if you send it? Can you put it in a song? And so they end up writing a little paper, and ultimately what comes out is these kids say, "You see that over there? No one should live in that. You see that? See the way that man is treating his family? That's wrong. You shouldn't do that. And you see that over? That shouldn't happen. And I can change it." So when you come from a child who, "I'm rubbish, I mean nothing, no one's ever going to listen to me," and come into a 15, 16, 17-year-old, they can see the problems around them. Not only they can see them and identify them, but now being equipped to be able to do something about it, "I can change that." Then you're winning the fight against poverty. We then have a university course called the Leadership Development Program, where we get Christian business people or Christians who have a little bit more money in their pocket, and we put these children through university in their own country in a subject of their choice. And it's a great opportunity for them. And we also provide, at that point of time, a Christian leadership course as well. Because prior to that, the first two programs, the common denominator is you are the poorest of the poor. It doesn't matter what religious background you come from, you can be put into a compassion project in the local church. That's no problem. But when it gets to the university one, if they've made a commitment of faith, then we have this double degree program. And then that fourth one, and that runs for the entirety of their study. Then the fourth one is the complementary interventions. So we saw about the toilets there. We had a bit of a laugh and a bit of a frown. It might be to put toilets in our project. Now, when we put toilets in a project and we find people who will fund those, it's not just for the kids in the centre, it's for the community as well. And so if it's a long drop toilet, we'll put in a block of long drop toilets, we will put in roofs that will harvest rainwater, we'll put in tanks, we'll put in hand basins so that they can wash their hands, and then we will have a community hygiene awareness program to teach them about germs and why you should wash your hands and what toiletry and proper sanitary does to keep them alive. So the CIV program could be anything from toilets to water wells to medical programs, to HIV/AIDS awareness blitzes. And all of these are done in the local church because Compassion believes a local church is an answer to a hurting world. God's answer to the hurting world. So there's Compassion. Let me shut up now and let me preach. No. We do it because God has asked us. God knows that there are poor people in the world. Was it over 2,000 verses we heard? Just tell them I'm busy for a couple of minutes. And he said, "I know, but you can do something. There's something that you can do. You can help." Now, Jesus did say, "The poor will always be with you," and I believe that he said it tongue-in-cheek. Maybe that's just my bad Churches of Christ theological upbringing. I think he said that because he knew that church he knew humanity too often falls short of what they're supposed to be doing. But nevertheless, Ruth. I'm not going to get you to read it because I go all over the place, so I'll read it. And just believe me that I'm reading out of the book of Ruth, and that I'm not just making it up as I go along. So there was a famine in the land, and the man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and his two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. Now Elimelech, Naomi's husband, who was the man, died, and she was left with her two sons, and they married Moabite women, one named Orpah and the other Ruth. And they lived there for about 10 years when both the husbands also died. And so now Naomi was left without her two sons and her husband. When she heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people by providing food for them, Naomi and her daughters-in-law prepared to return home from where they were. And the story goes on to say that Naomi and the two daughters started on their way back to Bethlehem, and Naomi had an epiphany, and she said, "Look, why, don't come. Don't come. I'm a bit of an old sort now. I'm probably not going to get married. If I did get married, I probably aren't going to have children straight away. And what's the likelihood of me of having two sons that would grow up to marry you? And would you wait long enough, the Bible says, to marry them?" So she dissuades them. Well, she tries to. Stay with your people. Stay with the Moabites. Marry there. Have a life for yourselves. Orpah says, yep, okay, I'll do it. You know, as broken hearted as I am, Mum, I'll stay. Ruth didn't. She said, no. She said, where you go, I'll go. Where you stay, I'll stay. Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. Where you die, I will die. May the Lord treat me ever so severely if it not be this way. And so Ruth went back with her mother-in-law. Now, sorry about that. Shouted into my microphone. Verse 22, so Naomi returned from Moab, accompanied by Ruth, the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, and arriving in Bethlehem as the barley harvest was beginning. And Ruth said to Naomi, let me go to the fields and pick up the leftover grain behind anyone whose eyes I find favour. And so she went out and she began to glean in the fields behind the harvesters. And she gleaned all day. And she worked steadily from morning until the afternoon, where she had a short break. And so then she went on and she gleaned in the field until evening. And then she threshed the barley and she had gathered, and it amounted to about an ephah. And she carried it back to town, and her mother-in-law saw how much she had gathered. And so Ruth stayed close in the coming days with the servant girls of Boaz and gleaned until the barley and wheat harvests were finished. Who's heard of that story before? We should have got it in Sunday school for those of us who grew up in the church. It happens. It's an interesting story. Have you ever been, can you remember what you were last grateful for? What was the last thing you had gratitude? Something that happened to you, or something that came your way and you thought to yourself, oh, I am so grateful for this. I am so fortunate. Or it may have been that you didn't realise at the time, but now later on in life, you look back and you go, that was a pivotal moment. I'm where I am today because of this particular thing. I want to go back to books, into Deuteronomy, because I want to be able to tie what happened with Ruth and Naomi back there in Jerusalem to God. Be a good idea in the sermon, wouldn't it? So in Deuteronomy 24, verse 9, it says, now when you're harvesting, now this is Moses talking to the Israelites, now when you're harvesting in your field and you overlook a sheaf, do not go back and get it. Leave it for the alien, the fatherless, and the widow. So the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. And when you beat the olives from the trees, don't go over the branches a second time. Leave what remains for the alien, the fatherless, and the widow. And when you harvest the grapes in your vineyard, do not go over the vines again. Leave what remains for the alien, the fatherless, and the widow. Remember that you were slaves in Egypt. That is why I command you to do this. And then over in Leviticus 19, it just pictures it a slightly different way. It says, when you reap the harvest of your land, do not reap to the very edges or the corner of your field or gather the gleanings of your harvest. Do not go over your vineyard a second time or pick up the grapes that have fallen. Leave them for the poor and the alien. I am the Lord your God. You could hear them saying, that's not fair. That's not fair. I've worked tirelessly. I got up in the early hours of the day when the sun rose and I started and I prepared the field and I ploughed the land and I planted the seed and I've watered the crop and I've taken away the weeds and I've nurtured them as they've grown through the season, and now it's come to harvest and you're saying, don't take it all. But that's probably the thoughts of a person whose eyes are focused on I need, I want, I have, I own. It's easy to do that. It's easy to go that way. I want to put this in perspective for us. The Israelites that Moses is talking to were in slavery in Egypt, weren't they? They'd been there, they'd been given a pretty hard time. For about 400 years they'd been wallowing there. They had gone in some good times, but as the ages went on, no one remembered who brought them there, and they were forgotten and they became slaves. And so they were given a tough time. Didn't have all that much, were beaten, so forth and so on. God has promised them a land that flows with milk and honey. But they're not there yet. It's still some way off. It's over there. And the good thing about God is he sees the beginning and the end and everything in between. And so he says to Moses, as he's gone through the Decalogue, he's given the Ten Commandments, he's etched them in stone. There's a few other things that come out, and this is one of the laws that come out at the end of it. And he says, look, by the way, he said, when you get into the land of milk and honey, there are going to be good times, and you are going to have a harvest. Keep the edges of your harvest for the poor. One of the beautiful things that, have you noticed it? He didn't say, glean everything and then give it to the poor. He said, leave the edges. Then the poor can come and they can take it. Naomi didn't wait at home for charity for a handout. She got a hand up that said, look, if you want to come along, there's stuff there if you want to work for it. And it says she worked from morning till night, and she stayed there for the whole of the harvest. There's God's provision there. If you know anything about the start of the commandments, there's Moses, and he's giving a serious talk to the Israelites, and he's telling them what they should do and how they should honour and respect and do all that God's asked them and commanded them to do. For this is your just and right thing to do. And then this is rolling in after it. So they've come, and I think I titled this message when Michael rang up. I said, oh, look, just call it God's grace. And here's, I think, where God's grace comes in, because, I don't know, I'm in my 50th year now, and I'm finding I know less now than I did when I was younger. I love that bumper sticker that says, hire a teenager while they still know everything. Because now I'm older, I seem to know a lot less than I did when I was a teenager. But I look back and I look at my life and I go, everything I have, everything I've achieved, everything I've got is due to God. And I'm a custodian of what he gives me. I remember when my three kids were born, we didn't do baby dedications in my day. But when they popped out, within the next couple of hours, Michelle and I would grab a hold of them when they wrapped tight. We'd say, God, this was Harmony. Harmony was our first one. This is Harmony. She's yours. We're going to look after her, but we're just committing her back to you. We'll do our best to bring her into a relationship with you, but she's yours. We'll have her for a few years, but she's yours. And then we did the next with Corey, with the last with Brody, all the same. And our house has been the same. When we were finally in a position where we could buy a house, we said, Lord, this is our house, but it's for you. If anyone ever wants to use it, they can use it. If the church ever wants to come around and wreck it, they can come and use it and not wreck it. Because everything has been a gift from God. And so we look here at the context and we go, they've come out of slavery. God prepared the way, God's grace. They were fed and watered daily, God's provision, God's grace. He was there leading them night and day, God's presence, God's grace. He was heading them to the promised land, God's present, God's grace. They were going to be reaping a harvest, God's prosperity, God's grace. They were going to be leaving or a redeeming portion, God's gift, God's grace. And so I see a few things. Where I said before about the you could hear people saying, why? I've done this, I've done that, this isn't fair, it's mine. And then I look at it and I go, well, God provided the seed for the wheat, for the grape, for the olive tree. He provided the dirt that they were planted in. He provided the rain that helped to feed them. He provided the sun that helped grow them. He provided the season that brought them to harvest. He provided the bulk of the harvest for the landowner. He provided the food for the poor, the widow and the orphan. He provided a way for those who were blessed to be able to redeem those who were oppressed. And God provides a way for you and me to love our neighbours. Why remember the poor? Well, God's saying because you were once slaves, you were once oppressed, you were once cut off. You didn't have a lot when you started. You didn't have the options. You were stopped from reaching your potential. But then you were set free. So you see how Ruth ties in. Ruth comes back with her mother-in-law. Their husbands have died. They don't have anything. They're in that realm of orphan, widow, poor, alien. And they are allowed to take a little bit from the corner that's been left behind along the edges. It's a provision for them. God said, this is going to happen. There's going to be people here, and I want you, as people who have been blessed, to be able to care for them with what I've given you. Can you remember another time in the New Testament? Now, those who are here this morning, they know the answer to this one. But in the New Testament, we see this happen once more. And you'll find that Jesus on the Sabbath and his disciples were walking down the road, and they took grain from the side of the road, from the fields there, and they were rubbing it between their hands and blowing away the chaff. And they got in trouble by the leaders for what? Not for stealing, was it? It was for working on the Sabbath. They were exercising the law which said they were allowed to do it. I don't know what your situations or what your situation is or has been, but even here in Australia, we can look back and there can be times when we may have lost everything. We may have become bankrupt. We may have had a situation where our health has gone. We may have had all sorts of things or one thing that's happened in us that has set us back and taken us from where we thought we were and put us into a situation where we thought we would never be. And maybe we've been able to come out of that with help from others, or maybe we're working our way out of it. Maybe we took it for granted, and I said to you before, what's the last thing that you were grateful for? When I was born, I didn't know how to walk. I know it's strange. I wasn't the average sort of child. But somewhere in that first 12 months, I learnt how to walk. I think you all did, didn't you? Then about 10 years after that, I was involved in a serious road accident, which just about ended up having my right leg taken off just below the knee. And fortunately, they found the surgeon who was on holidays, and in the early hours of the next morning, he came and he operated and he saved the leg, and then through a series of more operations and bits and pieces and steel and screws and whatnot, they were able to reconstruct it, and I can now walk on it. But I couldn't. And so I found as a 10-year-old, I had to learn to walk again. And so I never thought at 10 that I'd be learning to do the basics that I had when I was one, but I found it again. And it took me longer when I was 10 to learn to walk than it did when I was one. Well, let's roll the hands of time on a little bit. And about 5 years ago, I found that I had contracted a debilitating autoimmune disease that was eating away my bones, and for quite some time I was pretty much, when I was at home, I would be seat bound. I would grit my teeth and load myself up with Panadol to get out during the day and do what I had to do on the work side, but when I got home I was down for the count. So then at Christmas time, well, there's been a bit of prayer, a lot of prayer actually, a lot of laying on of hands and a lot of development in the medical profession. And so now with the wonders of drugs, I can smile and be pretty much pain-free. And at Christmas time, they chopped off my hip and built in a new one and ground out the socket and put in a new cup and whacked it all together. But I had to learn to walk again at 50. So three times Talk about a mug. And I think the third time I realized how I should never take it for granted. We can take so many things for granted. God has blessed us in so many, many ways. Our time is gone. I'm not going to rush in and go on about the blue square. We have a blue square on everything that we have. The blue square, some brilliant genius person in our international office paid someone a lot of money to come up with our branding. That blue square, and I'm looking at it going, I don't know how they got paid that much, but anyway, the blue square actually represents leaving a corner of your field for the poor. And it's a reminder for us at Compassion to realize that there is something that needs to be left behind for the poor. So we don't hide it, we put it there on the front of things. So most of us, granted, aren't farmers. Like I said, some of us may have a vegetable patch out the backyard. I have a brown thumb. None of the vegetables grow in my garden. But some people may be better than that. But whether it be a vegetable garden, or whether it be business, or whether it be an investment, or whether it be in our intellect, or whether it be in many other things that the Lord has blessed us, I'm sure that we have something in some way, shape, or form that can help others. Whether it be here in our own country, whether it be abroad.